Hey, it's Andrew, the Director of Literary Arts. Here at Literary Arts, we rely on our community, people like you, for support. To help make this podcast and all our programming possible, give today, literary-arts.org/donate. Welcome to the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 35 years of literary arts in Portland. Support for the Archive Project is provided by Cole Haan. Cole Haan's shoes, bags, and outerwear go with you while you work your way to extraordinary. More at colehaan.com. In this episode, we're broadcasting an event that took place at the Portland Book Festival in November 2019. The panel, titled High Stakes, Rebellion, and Resistance, features three incredible Oregonian writers, April Henry, Taylor K. Mejia, and Renee Watson. It was moderated by Emily Suveda. All three of the novels discussed in this episode center young women who find themselves in precarious situations in which they must decide whether or not to take the risk to step up the fight, whether against an active shooter, a corrupt regime, or the high school principal. The joy of reading the work of these writers and hearing them in conversation is that they all meet their young characters where they are. This is a conversation about activism and the role of art, the meaning of community and family, and about the sometimes indirect and messy ways we arrive at new levels of awareness of who we are and who we want to be. And all three of these writers are engrossing storytellers who are engaging the complicated, challenging, and sometimes violent or oppressive reality that our young people face, making them important writers we should all read, no matter our age. Here's our moderator, Emily Suveda.
My name is Emily Suveda. I am the author of the young adult science fiction series, This Mortal Coil. I have the great honor of introducing three wonderful authors today. So, Renee Watson is the New York Times bestselling, Newbery Honor and Coretta Scott King Arthur Award-winning author of the novels Some Places More Than Others, Watch Us Rise, co-written with Ellen Hagen, Piecing Me Together, This Side of Home, What Mama Left Me, Betty Before X'd, and two picture books. Very prolific. I'm intimidated. Renee is the founder of I2 Arts Collective, a nonprofit committed to nurturing underrepresented voices in the creative arts, and she lives in New York City. Taylor K. Mejia is an author and Oregon native in love with the alpine meadows and evergreen forests of her home state where she lives with her daughter. When she's not writing, you can find Taylor plucking at her guitar, stealing rosemary sprigs from overgrown gardens, me too, or trying to make the perfect vegan tamale. She is active in the Latinx lit community and passionate about representation for marginalized teens in media. And April Henry is the New York Times bestselling author of many acclaimed mysteries for adults and young adults, including the YA novels Girls Stolen, The Night She Disappeared, and the thriller Face of Betrayal, co-written with Liz Wheel. Her most recent novel is a mystery thriller, Run, Hide, Fight Back. Please welcome our authors. To start, I'm going to have each author read just a really short excerpt from their latest book, introduce themselves, and tell us a little bit about what the book is like. Renee, would you like to start?
Good afternoon, everyone. I am going to be reading from Watch Us Rise, and I'm reading from the perspective of Jasmine. Watch Us Rise is told from two perspectives, Jasmine and Chelsea. And these are two poems that my character, Jasmine, writes in the book. She's talking about her body and what it means to be a black girl who is also big and dark-skinned and how she has to navigate space. This is her poem, Walking the Streets in New York City. Hello, men of New York City. This is a teenage girl calling you again. A girl who walks past whistling men on my way to school, on my way from school, to and from everywhere I go. This is just to say, I am not an object to call back to you like a yo-yo. Don't tug at me, pull me close. My body is not yours for taking, grabbing, slapping, commenting on. I am not the quench for your thirst. Don't tell me to smile. Don't make my fatness your fetish. Don't tell me my fatness is your disdain. My body is not yours for taking, grabbing, slapping, commenting on. Let me walk in peace. Let my feet be high-heeled or combat boots. Let my face be in deep thought or anger or laughter or just be. Let me be without trying to make meaning of who I am. Don't call me baby, ma, sexy. Don't rename me. You can't name what you do not own. You do not own my body. My body is not yours. This body. My body is perfect and imperfect and black and girl and big and thick hair and short legs and scraped knee and healed scar and heart beating and hands holding, and voice that bellows, and feet that dance, and arms that embrace, and my mama's eyes, and my daddy's smile, and my grandma's hope. And my body is a masterpiece, and my body is mine.
All right, I'm gonna need like 5 minutes to stop crying. That was beautiful. Hi, everybody. My book is We Set the Dark on Fire, and it's set in a Latinx-inspired fantasy world where there's a class revolution currently going on, and this is a girl who has forged identification papers trying to get through a government checkpoint. After a childhood in Polvo, beneath the shadow of the border wall, Dani thought she might never get used to the deference the police showed the wealthy. Her papers securely in her lap, she watched as officers approached the glossy cars ahead with smiles, even laughter, a far cry from the scowling menaces who had made their way through Polvo once a week, scattering chickens, terrifying children and adults alike as they searched for stolen merchandise, punished families for hoarding food, and looked for people to send back over the wall. Dani couldn't remember ever feeling as small as she had on inspection days, and that had been their goal, to intimidate, to punish. Simply because she and her neighbors had been born with less. But she wasn't the same person she'd been then, Dani reminded herself. She had spent 5 years in the company of the country's wealthiest daughters, learning their ways, becoming worthy of the family she was now part of. That, along with her training, could be used to her advantage. "Good morning, ladies," said a young officer when they reached the front of the line. Mama Garcia waited until the last possible moment to roll down the window, as if the air outside held something contagious. "We're so sorry for the interruption. With the influx of new faces around graduation time, we need to make sure we're not letting in anyone unworthy." "Make it quick," said Senora Garcia, scarcely making eye contact with the officer. Every girl Dani had ever been, from a scared child sneaking across the border to now, sat in awe of the way she dismissed him and the way he let her.
And I'm April Henry. I am wearing a blouse with Tiny Ruth Bader Ginsburg's heads on it. That has nothing to do with anything, but I want you guys to admire it. So my book is called Run, Hide, Fight Back. It's about six teenagers who are trapped at a shopping mall when there's domestic terrorists that attack it, and they have to decide whether they're gonna run, hide, or fight back. So this chapter is about six chapters in. 3:59 p.m., Miranda has to get out of here. To get to any of the other exits, she's going to have to cut back through the food court, but there are fewer and fewer people left alive out there, and those few are even more obvious targets. She ventures back to where the hall meets the food court. In front of LA Nails, sheltered by the overhang, she tries to figure out what to do, how to stay alive. She spots Parker underneath one of the escalators. He's screaming his little sister's name as he frantically scans the area. The busboy Parker was taunting is dragging the rich girl whose mother was shot across the open space. They are almost clear when there's another pop, pop, pop. He grabs his thigh and he keeps lurching forward. A whistle carries even over the fire alarm. Miranda looks for its source. A tall, thin guy standing just inside Culpepper's pulls his fingers from between his lips. On the other side of the entrance is that dark-skinned clerk, the one who wears a headscarf. She beckons Miranda with an urgent hand. With the other, she's pulling down the roll-down metal security shutter. Miranda runs towards the closing shutter like her life depends on it, knowing that it does.
So in today's panel, we are discussing three books with really strong energy and strong heroes who need to find strength, who need to fight back and learn to believe in themselves. And all these books, they take us on deeply emotional journeys where your characters face violence, oppression, and hate. And the subject matter, although it's fiction, it often feels closer to reality. As a writer, how do you find the strength and the clarity to explore those subjects honestly and explore the fear and the pain that your characters experience while taking care of yourself as a writer?
I think a big part, one of the big themes in my book is just like not feeling guilty for feeling joy when the world is falling apart. So I had to be focusing on that because I was writing it, and I think that helped me get through a lot of the hard parts, because that is really difficult when you're writing about oppression and, you know, hate and things that are actually affecting your community and your family, and you're trying to like express that so that people understand it, but also not to just drown in it all the time. So in We Set the Dark on Fire, there's like a love story going on underneath the kind of revolution, and I wanted to make it clear that like it's okay to feel happy and it's okay to feel joy, and that doesn't take away from your fight, you know, like it's necessary to connect with people and to feel those like positive, happy emotions and to let yourself feel them and not feel guilty for feeling them. So I think a big part of my process is just letting myself have that and not feeling like I should be out here doing something hard or else I'm not resisting right, because joy, if you're a marginalized person, joy is resistance too.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I think we can hold many things at once. And I think it's important for young people to see that. So to see a character who is having a crush on someone and having homework and parent, you know, things that their parents want them to do, responsibilities, and also that they care about the world and what's going on, that is life. That is what it is about. It's figuring out how to balance all of that. And so I try to create characters that are, yes, they're like starting a revolution and they're fighting back and pushing against oppression and stereotypes, but they're also just teenagers living and growing and having fun. Me personally, I find strength from writing. Writing is an outlet for me, and then also my family, and just taking a break sometimes and saying, you know what? I'm living this life too. I am in this skin. I am having to deal with this very things I'm writing about. So yeah, I need a break. And just giving myself permission to take that break is also something I'm trying to practice more and more.
For me, I had an unusual situation. I've never had this happen before. This was supposed to be my 22nd book, but actually turned out being my 24th, right after Parkland. My publisher decided that the book was too sensitive, even though the book was about domestic terrorism and not about a kid coming to school with a gun. So they pulled the book and put it on hold, and it didn't come out for almost a year and a half from when it was supposed to come out. Which is weird, I've never had a book pulled for being kind of topical, but, and for me, I feel like my message is that I think there's always things you can do in a bad situation. There are always ways that you can fight back. I feel like if you're clever, there are things that you can do and you don't just have to accept it. And in my personal life, I'm a super happy person and hardly anything ever gets me frightened. I don't know. I don't think anyone is ever going to kill me. And plus, if they did, I would sell so many books afterwards. I mean, I would be dead. That's a drawback.
We need to talk about this later, because I think everyone is going to kill me.
So when I was checking out the social media accounts of our panelists, aka stalking them, I saw that Renee had posted this really beautiful excerpt from a poem by Gwendolyn Brooks, and this really struck me as being so relevant to the books in today's panel. Now, the lines read, "We are each other's harvest. We are each other's business. We are each other's magnitude and bond." In all of these books, we share the common thread of strong and brave heroines, but they also show the power of finding strength in each other, and that working together makes us stronger. Can you each tell me about the bonds between your characters and how those bonds are crucial to their stories?
Okay. I had to make notes because there's like six of them, and I was afraid I'd forget somebody. So there's Miranda. You heard her point of view. She starts out the book as a shoplifting Oxy addict, which is probably as dark as I've ever gone for a high school character. And she ends up finding herself the leader of this group, kind of unexpectedly. She's been kicked out of the store where Amina, who's a Somali-American, works. And so they start off kind of with this relationship between them that is not that good because of this shoplifting incident. There's also Parker, who's a state champion wrestler. And he begins the book taunting Javier, who's a kid who works in the food court as a busboy and is also an undocumented immigrant. And then finally, there's Cole, who comes from a military family, and he bonds with this girl named Grace, who is on the run from a court-ordered cancer treatment. So they kind of find... they both have some conspiracy theories that bind them together. So initially, a lot of the people are kind of on the outs together, but in order to have success and to survive, they have to trust each other and they have to work together.
So Jasmine and Chelsea are best friends. They grew up together. They went to elementary and middle school together, and now they're in high school. Jasmine is an African-American girl, and Chelsea is white. And a lot of their friendship is built on that very thing, that they have always been allies for each other and standing up for each other and figuring out what it means to have an interracial friendship. And there are moments in the book, we wanted to make sure that for this book, race wasn't an issue between the two girls. They love each other and have figured out how to be friends with each other. But there are some shortcomings that Chelsea has because Jasmine is a big girl. And there are some blind spots that she has when she makes mistakes and orders shirts that her best friend, who she's known her whole life, she doesn't get a size that Jasmine can fit. And so there's conflict in the book about just how can you be so woke in one area of your life and so aware and so, you know, fight the power, and then in other ways you don't even get it at all. And what does it mean to be on your growing edge and also really strong in some other way? And so the girls are learning that you can be an activist and still have flaws and still have some learning to do, and that that's an important part of learning how to advocate for people. You don't have to be perfect. You just have to be willing to learn and open to listening. So that's a big theme in the book. And the boys in the book are feminists too. Their friendships with the boys are very much like, Isaac says, please don't call me. Like, they have kind of like a mascot. They treat him like he's an extra thing. He's like, no, I am a feminist too, and I believe in what you're fighting for. So there's really strong friendships throughout the book, and we really wanted to show what it is like to lean on your community and be there and show up for each other.
They have like a group name. The
Artivist, yes. So they're artists and activists, and it's that word. I did not make up that phrase, but it is something that a lot of young people I work with identify as. They use their art to speak out and speak up against injustice.
I think when I was growing up, there was this prevailing attitude that, like, in order to be a strong girl, you couldn't be like a girl. You couldn't be like other girls. You couldn't be friends with girls. You always had to kind of be, like, antagonistic with the whole world. Like, in order to fight, you had to fight everything and everyone all the time. And I was so a victim of this, like, all the way through high school. I was like one of those I'm not like other girls. And it took me so long to realize that, like, this, a lot of our strength in resisting comes from within our communities and comes from, you know, not allowing that sort of social stereotype to divide us from each other. And so my main character starts out feeling that way for sure. Like, she has a lot of secrets, so she feels like she has to isolate herself, but also she just really looks down on, like, people who are different from her, especially other women who are different from her. And so she has, like, a long uphill climb in the book of learning how to open herself up to social connections and love and friendship and community, and learning that, you know, in order to fight, you don't have to fight everything and you don't have to fight alone. So that's definitely a big theme for her in the book.
I feel like high school students need to hear that in an academic sense sometimes, you know, like working together instead of trying to be number one can really help you.
Do you want to talk about how the public school system is broken now?
I want to add, though, I think it is important to think about the adults in our books too, and we were very mindful to make sure that the adults were a part of the story in a real way and not just like placeholders or like these stereotypical characters, but we really wanted to show the range of adults that show up for our young people in every way, the good and the not so great ways. So we have some problematic teachers and folks in the book who are not at their best, and then absolutely teachers who are listening and open and trying to guide these students along the way. And I think the intergenerational community that is in Watch Us Rise and a lot of young adult novels is important for the adults too to read and think about, how am I showing up for young people, and am I listening, and am I really thinking about supporting them and helping them be their best selves?
Now, April, your books are among the most well-researched I've ever read. They're amazing. I learn things from your books. So Run, Hide, Fight Back is built on knowledge about not only survival training, but how shopping malls work and specialized firefighting tools. I feel like I could do a heist in a shopping mall after reading this book. So tell me about your research process, and were there any adventures that you undertook for this book?
I love research. I have done it all. Sometimes for a specific book and sometimes just because it's interesting. Like a few years ago, I took a 3-day class in LA where it's an anti-kidnapping class, and you learn how to get out of duct tape and rope and zip ties and handcuffs. And
you brought handcuffs. For those listening, April Henry brought handcuffs.
That's the headline. Like when they write about this, it's going to be like, April Henry brought handcuffs. That's our panel.
In August, I was the only person who was a civilian at a forensic scientist thing that was for people who work for the cops. And I just went, for a current book, I just went to a Society for Creative Anachronism, a combat class they had. And I was going to LARP last weekend, and the LARPers kicked me out, the live action role players. They were suspicious of me. So
you're too cool.
Did you bring your handcuffs? I wonder why.
You know, LARPers actually do some lock picking in LARP. So, and I just was learning about food grade plastics for a character whose dad sells food grade plastics. But for this book, I watched the documentary on the Kenya Mall shooting, which is definitely probably too intense for teenagers. And for my bad guys, I took my dad was targeted 35 years ago by Posse Comitatus when he was a Jackson County commissioner, and they called our house and said they were going to kill him. And then to make sure we got the message, they called the sheriff's office and said they were going to kill him. So when I was looking at bad guys, I looked at somebody, a group like Posse Comitatus. Those right-wing groups are actually, as we've seen now, a lot of times they're behind some really horrific events. I wanted... For a mall shooting, I was like, well, things are over so quickly. How can I make it be that it lasts longer? Because their cops are taught to storm in right away. So I worked with this firefighter and first responder in Washington who gave me some really clever ideas. And I'm not a gun person, but he's a gun person, so he helped me with my guns. He helped me with how could you treat a bullet wound if you did not have anything on hand to treat it. And I took a class with an active shooter training. And then I even wanted to know if I had a store, and it was so many square feet. What's the rule on how many exits a store has to have? So there's a lady who works as a plans examiner. And so she, for Lake Austin, I think she works for Clackamas County now, but she told me all about the rules for how many exits you have to have. I found some guy who is a door security president of a company, and was asking him about how to unlock doors that needed to be unlocked and lock doors that shouldn't be locked. And so people are really great about, people like to answer questions. The lady who is the head of the Target security here in downtown showed me all these clever things that shoplifters have done. And so now, like, if like writing doesn't work out, I could totally shoplift my way. So people like to answer questions, so I like to ask questions.
I feel like you're definitely on some watch list.
I was just about to say that. Definitely.
Sir Renee, I write science fiction, and one of the things that gets me excited about books, especially modern contemporary books, is when we look at how technology affects our lives. And your book is not science fiction, but one thing I loved about Watch Us Rise was the exploration of how the internet and online communities can provide an expressive outlet and a safe space for teens. But on the flip side, it can also be a space of just unmitigated hate. Can you tell me about how online expression shaped your characters' stories?
Sure. So the two girls start a blog as a part of their after-school club, and the blog goes viral. And in the beginning, it goes viral, and there's a lot of love for it, and all the comments are really great. And then it takes a turn, and some of the comments are not so great, and starts a real-life drama in the book. And so, you know, I've worked with young people and I've thought a lot about social media and how that can be used for good. And I used to work at an organization in the Bronx called Dream Yard. And we had an international poetry exchange program where our students in the Bronx were sharing poems with students in Japan and in Korea. And that was all just viral, just, you know, over social media. And then in person, we got to meet and travel there, and those students came to the US. And so I think there are ways to build community that are beautiful. When you can't find community in your actual space, your school, your neighborhood, maybe there are not people who look like you or who are like-minded, but you can then go out and find your people, find other poets, find other activists, and follow them and engage with them. And so that is a beautiful thing. And I've seen that work in real life with teenagers, and it's powerful. And I feel like it gives them a voice that sometimes maybe they don't know that they can use quite yet. It's a way to kind of start sharing your work and getting it out into the world in a way that lets people know what you're thinking and what you feel. Yeah, so that's been a beautiful thing.
I love that you talked about like the internet being a positive thing, because I feel like there's this kind of attitude that it's like, oh, the internet's bad, kids are just on their phones all the time, and like it's the worst thing. We used to play outside with sticks, and now, you know?
Yes.
But I love that you looked at, like, you know, actually, because I think back to like being a totally isolated kid with like nobody who was like me, and like that could have been a really cool experience.
I say that all the time. Like, you can find your people if you're looking in the right places. And yes, we already know all the things that are not working. So I don't need to necessarily highlight that in the book. I want to show what it can look like in a positive way. So we tried to make like a real mindful choice to show what it can look like when young people gather first off of the internet and then in person, and the power behind that. And that it's not, I didn't make it up, it's happening in real life.
It's real, yeah.
Right? It actually is a thing that is happening all over the world, which is really powerful to me.
So Taylor, in We Set the Dark on Fire, your main character Danny has to question a lot of things that she's been taught. Now, there are many things that frighten me about the future, obviously. I write science fiction. But one thing that makes me really hopeful is the way that young people today, especially, are doing a lot of work to deprogram themselves and question harmful and restrictive ideas about gender and about sexuality. And this deprogramming often brings about a more nuanced or a wholly surprising view of their own identity. Can you tell me a bit about Danny's story of deprogramming?
Yeah, I did an event in like rural Pennsylvania, and there was this like 12-year-old girl, which I feel like 12 is kind of young for my book, I don't know, but she had like read it and just was so into it, and I was like, does anyone have any questions? And she was like, bam, firsthand, and I was like, this is so cute. And she was like, why doesn't Danny want to destroy the patriarchy right away? And
yes,
I was like, damn, like, okay, well. And it was a really good question, because I did it on purpose. But she asked me, though. She was like, did you mean to do it like that? Like, I feel like we have to wait until, like, page 100 before she's, like, ready to actually do anything. And I was like, I think a lot of us start like that. I mean, like, we don't wake up one day when we're, like, 10 years old and go, like, I already know everything right. And also, because of, you know, positive internet spaces and negative ones even, like, our language and our way to interpret what's going on in the world is constantly evolving. So like, even I thought I was like a pretty woke 14-year-old, but a lot of the stuff I thought when I was 14, super problematic now. And you absorb things from your family and your culture and like people who are older than you, and have, you know, my family is really woke in some ways, and also like has a big anti-blackness problem, like a lot of people in Latinx communities do. So I feel like it was important to me to show that you don't have to be there already. Like, you don't have to already know exactly what's wrong with the world and exactly who you are in it in order to fight back. You can start from a place of not knowing anything and actually start from a place of having like problematic views and not being on the right track, and that it's not too late to come around. It's not too late to open your eyes. And I think what's great about Dani as a character is that she's stubborn and she's determined, but she's also very willing to admit when she's wrong, and she has her eyes open. She's looking around, she's absorbing things. And I think it's powerful for people to know, you know, you don't have to already be the smartest, most woke person in the world. Like, you can absorb that stuff, you can learn it from the people around you, you can learn it from your community and in your spaces. And so, yeah, I wanted to show a little bit of the trajectory of that, because a lot of what's happening now is like the people in the media who are, you know, the big activists, teen activists, like they already know all the language, they seem to like have everything already figured out. And I see sort of like this discouragement in some of the kids like I've met through just working in schools and stuff, that they're like, oh, but I don't know all that stuff, so how can I possibly be useful? But all you really have to do to be useful is want to be useful and be willing to learn. And I think like Dani's journey really shows that, so.
That's a great question.
I saw you nodding a lot, Renee.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I think also there's an expectation a lot of times, especially on young girls, to be perfect. And I think what our books are also trying to do is show that we are not flawed, but nuanced, that there's a lot of parts of me that exist at the same time. And sometimes those parts can feel like they contradict each other, and that's okay. And that young people need to see themselves as whole people, not just as a young person or as an activist, as a daughter, but you're all those things. And what does that look like for you? And that it doesn't have to look like kind of the poster board that we've kind of held up as, this is an activist with a capital A. But how are you an activist in your everyday life? I don't really want to hear your speech on stage. I want to know how you live in and how you really are treating people and listening to them or not. That part is what I want young people especially to be thinking about, is this the everyday little things you can do that might not be those big, big things, that those matter and actually add up over time and make you the big capital A activist, leader, change maker.
And I think I say this all the time, but like, my characters are going through, like, they're learning, you know, who they are within their culture, who they want to be in their world, do they want to be the people that their parents want them to be. Mm-hmm. Also, they're figuring out, like, their gender identities and their sexualities, and also they're, like, trying to just live their regular lives and, like, eat some food and go to school. And I was saying this on a different panel, but, like, it's not like you get assigned days of the week to work all that stuff out. Like, oh, it's Tuesday, time to think about, like, your gender identity. It's like, you have to do it all in this big soup. Mm-hmm. So, like, yeah, that's not going to look perfect, and, like, that's okay. Yeah.
So one thing that struck me while reading these stories was that they each have a different expression of hatred within them that the characters have to face. So there's fat shaming and racism, and then there is a misogynistic classist social structure, and then straight out armed gunmen with a nationalist agenda. And so these different expressions of hate that today's young people will experience at various stages of their lives. Well, hopefully not the armed gunman, but it is an ever-present threat in America today. So I believe that fiction is an important tool for fighting back against hate. I think it's one of the best weapons that we have. What are the messages that you're hoping to teach readers through these books? What are the things that you're hoping that they're going to take away and that they're going to absorb into their lives? Would you start us off, April?
Hello. I was thinking about, while you were talking, this isn't really about my book or anything, but I was thinking about that idea that books, we need books as windows and mirrors. I'd credit that to the right person, but I can't remember her name right now. And I think
Dr. Rudine Sims Bishop.
And you're active in We Need Diverse Books, right? So I think one of the ways that we fight against hate is to have this huge diversity of books that kids can pick up and read and see themselves in, or get an idea of what it's like to be somebody else that you're never going to be, but you can have an understanding about them because you've read this book. So that doesn't have anything to do with my book. I mean, in my books, it would be more that I want people who read my books to feel like they could do brave things even if they don't feel brave, that you don't have to feel brave to act bravely, and that even under stress, we can be clever. So
yeah, you had a character I really remember, I think it's Cole, was pretending he was in a video game when he was in this situation. Yeah.
To try and make it not be so real.
Not feeling brave, but keeping moving.
I think in my book, one of the big things was talking about like the way that there can be oppression and violence and problematic stuff like within our own communities, because everyone, the good guys and the bad guys in my book, are all like, you know, inspired by Latinx culture. And that's been something that's been kind of tough for me. It's like you're growing up and you know sort of what the people who like hate you look like, but what happens when you look like those people, or what happens when it's your own family that has like problematic attitudes toward other cultures, and like what happens when there's like classist and like terrible attitudes within your own community and like with people you love, what do you do about that? And so I think it's important to, like, especially for young people to know that, like, especially within, like, close-knit families and, like, cultures that are really, like, you know, they expect you to act a certain way, I think it's important to know that, like, you don't have to behave that particular way to be a part of your culture. Like, our understanding of what culture is and what it means to belong to your culture is, like, always evolving. So it's okay to say, I don't want that to be my expression of my culture anymore. I don't want to believe the things that my parents believed because those things are problematic now, and we understand that. So like, it's okay to love your culture and love your people, but also like want your expression of that identity to evolve.
I think about what you're saying as celebrating and critiquing.
Yes.
And that you can do both. So many things I love about Portland, and I celebrate that a lot in my books. I write a lot about Portland, and then there's the critique of Portland also, and that you can have both of those things. So I hope young people take that away, that it is possible to love and critique complicated people, places, things. You know, that is just a part of life. And you don't have to throw people away or dismiss them or, you know, leave a place because it's just so problematic, dangerous, fill in the blank. But you can stay and love and figure out a way to grow there and also speak up. You know, you can do both things. I also, you know, I don't really think about what do I want to teach the reader. I feel like if I started the book that way, none of you would like it and want to read it.
It's so preachy.
It would sound
like
a speech or be very preachy. Yeah, exactly, an after-school special. So I mostly am coming from a place of, this is what I've witnessed, this is what I'm seeing happening, this is some of what's happened to me and people I love, and I want to show that and represent. I'm writing realistic fiction, so I want to make it seem real. And I want young people to interrogate that and ask questions. So I don't want young people to think like me, but I want them to think. I want them to be paying attention to what is happening in their world and then have something to say about it. So hopefully, and I think art is a great way to do that. So visual art, poetry, theater, et cetera, are ways that young people especially can raise their voices and put out into the world how they're feeling. So hopefully that's a takeaway too, that if you're feeling silenced and feeling like no one wants to hear you or you feel invisible, that writing a poem or making art and putting your work out into the world in small and big ways is a way to say, I'm taking up space. I'm here. You have to listen to what I have to say.
And that's what I love about just like the increasing diversity in kids' literature is like, I never read books when I was growing up that made me think, oh, I could do that, you know? And now it's like, we do. We get to read books, and like kids get to read books like, oh, that's written by someone who looks like me or like who is going through my same experience. And that's so powerful.
I agree with not explicitly writing messages in books, but if the message is how to escape from handcuffs, I'm okay with it.
That is useful.
Useful tools.
I wanted to ask you, since you've all written multiple books, you've written on deadline, what are your tricks for getting words on the page? What's the special sauce with your writing? Tell me.
Well, I was showing somebody that cartoon from Toothpaste for Dinner. It says, like, project begins, and then it says you F off during that part. And then it says deadline approaches. And then there's a tiny sliver at the end, and it says, all the work while crying. So,
were you watching me?
Outlines help me write pretty fast. One of the things I've been doing lately is trying to do more free writing, like take 10, 20 minutes, set a timer, say that I'm not going to stop writing, even if what I'm writing is this is stupid, this is stupid, this is stupid. And my job is just to keep my fingers moving on the keyboard, and whatever comes out, just follow it. If it's ridiculous, don't judge it, follow it. If it's violent, whatever. If it's funny, just keep writing. And I'd say probably 30% of what you write is junk, and another 35% is okay, and 35% is great, and stuff that you wouldn't have gotten to if you were kind of judging it and thinking about it. So a lot of people will do variants of that. I don't know if you guys have ever read the adult writer Kent Harouf. He used to go out to his writing barn, pull a cap over his eyes, right, and write. Now, I don't know what happened if your fingers got off the keyboard and you weren't on the home row. You'd ruin it. But I just like that idea of like turning down the brightness or putting a tea towel over it, just so you can't see what you're writing and you stop picking at it. Because you can just end up, a lot of people who are writing will end up with perfect first chapters and nothing else. And you need to be able to get past that and finish. And getting paid for it is also
that helps.
Useful.
That helps a lot.
The biggest motivator. I agree. I think you have to have something to revise. So just get out the first draft and let it be as messy and not so great as it needs and should be, because that's what a first draft is. Nobody writes the book that you actually buy from Powell's. That book has been written 15 times and edited and worked on and massaged, right? And so take the pressure off yourself is my advice, and just let yourself write and don't think, I have to write a really good novel. I have to write the perfect poem. No, you don't. You have to just write. That's what writers do. So write, get it out, and then when you go back to revise, for me anyway, that's when the real writing happens, and that's when I start really thinking about, okay, I have to do something with this mess that I've made, and how do I fix it and make it better? But that first draft is messy, to the point where I'll have paragraphs, and then I'll have parentheses. Something needs to happen here. And then I just go to the next thing. So I'm telling you, I forget my characters' names in the first draft. I'm like, Miss X. And then I'll keep going, because I don't want to go back to the first chapter to look up the name I gave some random teacher. So just, it's okay. Finish, and then start again when you rewrite and revise.
I barely have anything to add, because that's brilliant. That's just like not critiquing yourself along the way is really, because there's plenty of time. Like, you're going to critique yourself. Yes. Ideally, lots of other people are going to critique you. There's plenty of time. Like, don't rush to get to that part. That's right. Not the good. Yeah, I mean, I think it's about getting the pathway going. Like, I sit down and I write words. They don't have to be perfect words. Just, like, sit down and do it. And that's the hardest part, I think, is I'll, like, think and conceptualize and be like, I'm going to eventually sit down and write. Or I'll research, or I'll read a whole nonfiction book that is going to add up to, like, one line. And I'm like, I'm writing. No, I'm working. But no, you just have to sit down and write words. And I feel like it's, like, that's the secret. I wanted there to be, like, a better secret so bad. I was like, man, when I get there, I'll know what the secret thing is. And the secret is, like, if you're a writer, you just have to write down words all the time.
Well, and I think the secret is also to figure out what works for you, right? We always want to give advice that's like, what works for me is the thing, but it might not work for you. I can share practical things that I've done when I'm, like, on deadline and I'm feeling stuck. I will work with a work buddy. Even if they're not writing a book, I have a good friend who, she knits and she makes blankets and she sometimes makes them for people, so she does have a deadline. So we'll go to a coffee shop, she's knitting, I'm working, but we're just accountable to each other. We're making in the same space. We've said we're gonna be here for this allotted amount of time. So stuff like that helps me, but really, it really is just, you gotta do it. You can't think about it, talk about it, daydream about it. You
tweet
actually
about
have
it.
To.
Don't tweet about it.
I know, you definitely don't get on Twitter.
No.
Because that's the whole day. It's
that Twitter's not writing.
Yeah, that doesn't get the book written. Unfortunately.
So, a quick and kind of fun question to finish up our questions, and then I'm going to hand over the floor to you. There are a couple of themes and elements that tend to pop up in my writing no matter what it is that I'm writing. So, like, I love biotech, and there's always a little bit of body horror. I could write a happy, fluffy romance, and somebody's still gonna have to like pull a cybernetic implant out of themselves. I can't stop it. What are some elements that you find keep making their way into your books no matter what you're writing?
Arson. Why is it always arson? Like, arson. It really is, though. I swear. Like, every book, I'm like, I burned something down again. Like, I don't even mean to. It's just, like, the only way to solve the plot problem every time. I have to stop burning something down in every book. I think it's that and, like, just, like, anti-police sentiment probably is the big one. I'm writing a book for the Rick Riordan Presents imprint, so it's, like, for middle school kids. And an actual email I sent my agent when I sent him the first draft was, like, is this too much anti-police sentiment for middle school kids? And, like, luckily the answer was no, so I guess we'll see what people think. But, yeah, but I'm a fun, happy person, I swear.
Who sets the dark on fire?
Well, I guess I always have handcuffs or zip ties or something like that. And I bet every single one of my books has the sentence, the space between her shoulder blades itched as she waited for the bullet.
That's a selling point for me.
I know. I'll take two.
I'm trying to. I have a lot of things that kind of show up. I think one of the things is gathering around a meal. There's always, in any book that I write, there's gonna be some really good food and really good conversation happening around that food. Like, that's where you find out all the secrets, or you figure out who doesn't like each other. You get the, like, that's when I'm telling you something. So don't pay attention so much to what they're eating, although it is good. But pay attention to what's happening at that dinner table or at the restaurant. I tend to bring people around food and get them cutting up a little bit.
Do you cook?
I do.
I don't, and I like write food descriptions and then get mad that I like can't make the food. What it is? Yeah. Sorry.
Can we get some audience questions? Would anybody like to start in the yellow? Oh, that is a good question. So the question was, how do you title your books? And burn, have you ever thought of a better title after publication?
I think titles are hard. They're tough.
So hard.
For a long time, I was about 50-50 on my titles getting changed by my publisher. And I've liked some of my, like, The Body in the Woods was called Point Last Scene. I felt like that was a lot better title. Or Girl Stolen was called Shadows Walking Backward, and they said it was too literary. So
I love that, though.
I think you try and find something interesting. A lot of people look to Shakespeare or the Bible, look at something your character has said, but it's hard. I think it's tough to find a good title.
It's the hardest part of writing, and especially a novel. For some reason, I get my titles for my picture books first, and I write from that title. I don't know if it's because it's a shorter amount of space and I'm telling the story, so I already know what the kind of summary is of the book. But a novel, there's so much happening, and I don't necessarily know what's going to resonate with the reader, so what should be the focus of the title. I literally have title brainstorming sessions with my friends, and we, like, make post-it notes on my wall. We're making, like, it's a thing to come up with. It's really, really hard. But I have not had the, okay, we have a title, and then I regret it afterwards. Thank goodness. That would be, like,
that gave
so
me
hard.
Just to
so
hear
I
that.
Haven't had that happen yet. I hope that never happens. My editor helps a lot, too, with titles.
My editor helps a lot. Yeah, I've 100% of my titles have been changed. But my editor actually taught me a cool trick. So for the first one, I used a line from a poem for my first title, and she was like, we can't do that, so we have to come up with something else. So she said, make a list of like 20 words that like thematically feel like the book to you, like just anything. It doesn't have to be like something the book is about, just like any words that like resonate with the title to you, any words, write them down. And then she kind of like mad libbed them. It's like you shake them up and like kind of just put them in order. So she kind of like put them together into like 10 different combinations, and I just like picked the one I like the best. But now that's how I title everything. I just do the word board first and then arrange them after that.
Titled by numbers.
Still doesn't work, though, because they change them anyway.
Do we have another question here? This is a great question. So the question was, if you're in the middle of a scene and you get stuck, if you get blocked, How do you motivate yourself to move on?
I do a bunch of things. Like, I might pick up the nearest novel and find a sentence that one character says to another character, the first one I see, and make my character say it to someone and see what happens from that. Sometimes I will jump ahead and write a different scene. You don't have to write in order if you know what's going to come. Sometimes I have taken a friend out for coffee and said, I'm really stuck, I don't know what to do with this scene. And then they start blabbing about how I could change it, and while they're talking, I think of a much better idea.
Yes. That's my answer also.
That happens a lot.
I'm like, thank you so much for sitting here. Yeah. I'm not gonna use your thing.
You can let it rest, but I feel like as a beginning writer, sometimes if you let it rest, you never come back to it. I think it's better to force it and write something cruddy and then fix it later.
Yeah. Agreed. Introduce a new character in the scene. Sometimes someone showing up that my character does not like or really loves will make that character act in ways that surprise me. So if I don't know what to do with her, then I make someone show up in her life in that scene that's going to make it either super awkward or very comforting or take it to another place, and it usually surprises me and takes the story in a way that I didn't even know it was gonna go. And a lot of times my best scenes are those scenes where I've been really stuck and I've introduced a character that wasn't necessarily planned, and then it's opened up a whole new storyline for me.
I think Earl Stanley Gardner said send in a guy with a gun, so you could do that.
Or that.
Or handcuffs.
Or that.
I'm just taking notes, like those are all really good. That's awesome.
Thank you so much. This concludes our panel. Can you please thank our author?
That was a conversation between April Henry, Taylor K. Mejia, and Renee Watson from the Portland Book Festival in November 2019. The Portland Book Festival 2020 lineup has just been announced. The festival will take place online and on the radio from November 5th to the 21st. For more information about the author lineup and schedule, visit literary-arts.org. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 35 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Support for the Archive Project is provided by Cole Hahn, on a mission to fuel your big ideas. More at colehahn.com. Our show is produced by Krista Liguori for radio and podcast, with production oversight by Amanda Bullock and support from Liz Olofsson. Special thanks to Jyoti Roy and Alana Phelan and the entire Literary Arts staff, board, and community. This show would not be possible without them. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another episode of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.